You're listening to the OCD Stories podcast, hosted by me, Stuart Ralph. The OCD Stories is a podcast dedicated to raising awareness and understanding around obsessive compulsive symptoms. I do this through interviewing inspired therapists, psychologists, and people who have experienced OCD. Welcome to the OCD Stories. And welcome to episode 359, and in this one I got back on Dr. Stephen Phillipson. Steve is a licensed clinical psychologist who specialises in cognitive behavioural therapy for OCD. And in this one I got him on to share his view of the top six emotions of OCD. These are anxiety, guilt, shame, depression, anger and disgust. He discusses depersonalisation and derealisation and shares his experience of this, plus other emotions such as not having any feelings, resentment, and desperation. We discuss showing a relevance to the brain voice, having an urge and impulse, and much more. So that last one, having an urge and impulse, I've added as an addendum to the end of the episode. He actually says in the episode, I'm sure I forget something and may send you an addendum later. He did, in fact, send me an addendum a couple of days later, and that was on having an urge or an impulse. So I put that at the end of the show, but I'll introduce that at the end. And thank you to NoCD for supporting the podcast. NoCD offers effective and convenient therapy available in the US and outside the US. To find out more about NoCD, their therapy plans, if they currently take your insurance, or to download their free app, head to go.treatmyocd.com/theocdstories, or the link will be in the episode description. So thank you as always to you guys for your time. I deeply appreciate it, and I hope this episode helps and resonates with you in some way. And of course, thank you to Steve for his time too. I appreciate it. Without further ado, here he is. Welcome back to the show, Steve.
Always a pleasure, Stu.
Yeah, it's good to have you back on. So today we're going to talk about the top six emotions of OCD, as we just discussed, not the six emotions. But before that, just anything like an update on you or anything you want to share more generically, generally even?
No, I'm happy to say that if I could say post-pandemic, things are kind of getting back to normal. We're gradually seeing patients more and more face-to-face, but our around the world services are going as usual. And now I've got staff that are actually satellites. I've got a staff member in Israel, staff member in California. So that's sort of new post-pandemic.
Yeah, that's cool. That's brilliant. Yeah. So let's jump into it. So obviously, okay. When we discussed this initially, we were talking about OCD's six different emotions. Yes. Although a minute ago off air, you said it's the top six. Yeah. So yeah, I guess just to share, what are those and anything else you want to open with?
Sure. I'll go over the top six and then we can kind of get into each one. So, you know, OCD is a bit of a controversial diagnosis. In the last book that speaks about diagnoses in the world of psychiatry and psychology, OCD was controversially removed as an anxiety disorder. It was considered one of the six primary anxiety disorders, and it was taken out of that classification and put into its own diagnostic category, not longer, no longer considered anxiety disorder. As interesting as it is, this conversation is going to be about how OCD is clearly not just an anxiety disorder. And yet, I actually have retained the belief that it would be in the field's best interest to bring it back to being considered an anxiety disorder. I think for a lot of reasons, some of those including some of the stigma around OCD. We'll get into this a little later, but you know, a lot of people use the word mental illness to describe OCD, and I generally object to that. You know, in the world of mental illness, I reserve that classification for much more severe forms of mental challenges like schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. But, you know, it is a form of, mental health challenge. And to that degree, I think all humans possess a variety of mental health challenges. None of us, as I say in my choice article, escapes the mud hole. But so getting right to the top six emotions. So anxiety is, I believe, the number one and most common subset of the six emotions. Number two, I would say, would be guilt. Number three would be shame. Number four would be depression. And five would be anger. And six would be disgust. Each of these emotions can exist as a representation of an automatic mental emotional association, or they can exist as a much more complex endorsement of what we would call kind of irrational, distorted thinking. All five, other than anxiety, which in and of itself is probably the least complex of the top six emotions that we'll be discussing, and then three others at least that are not in that most familiar category. So, you know, anxiety, and I saw one of your recent podcasts, someone was talking about anxiety in and of itself. And so we won't get too much into it, but just to kind of clarify, anxiety is probably a basic representation or manifestation or byproduct of an amygdala's malfunctioning system. To have anxiety, it means that a person is having an excessive, strong emotional threat reaction to something that is considered not harmful. So it's interesting that I can be anxious about catching AIDS from a doorknob, but I would be fearful of being bitten by a poisonous snake. So being afraid or fearful of being attacked by a bear or bitten by a dog, that these are natural fearful reactions to things that can be actually harmful. Whereas by definition, to be anxious about something, it means in and of itself that the person's target for anxiety is predicated on something that in the world of statistics and reason are not really either highly unlikely or even possible. Although when I speak to people with, sexual orientation spiking or HOCD, they would say, hey, 10% of the population is gay. So clearly, I may be afraid of being gay. Or a pedophile spiker would say there are such things as pedophiles. So therefore, I may be a pedophile. So going back to anxiety, anxiety is the amygdala's basic brain's preparation for an emergency. The most common symptoms that come with anxiety are rapid heartbeat, sweating, perspiration, dizziness, numbness in the limbs, which in and of itself can spawn its own type of spike danger, dry mouth, twitches, nausea. And one of my patients many years ago used the term being mentally muddled, meaning that there's a sort of a lessened ability to concentrate and have access to one's wonderful mind's creativity or sense of familiarity. So that brings me to anxiety. I sort of call it anxiety on steroids or nuclear anxiety, which is DP, depersonalization, and DR, derealization. And there's actually a diagnosis of DPDR, where people have such intense levels of anxiety that they feel sort of very different from themselves, that they're in such a heightened state of distress, they sort of almost feel like they're out of their own body and they're not living their own familiar experience. And of the 37 panic attacks that I've had so far in my short life, I've had and experienced a DPDR within those panic attacks about maybe four or five times. And so I'm happy to be able to describe it and discuss that form of anxiety, not only academically, but also personally, because I can really understand being in the midst of a depersonalized, derealized experience, that it is incredibly overwhelming and mystifying. I mean, you really, I'm not sure, Stu, in your own experience, whether your level of anxiety ever brought you to that place where you not only felt anxiety, but you felt like your whole identity has been erased. And you know that you're sort of alive, and you sort of know that you're you, but you don't feel that familiar sense of being you. Have you had that?
I can honestly say that hasn't happened.
I'm not sure I would say you're lucky or, oh, too bad, because, you know, it really teaches you about the enormous capacity for our brain to really kind of melt down and create experiences that are very overwhelming. And it's sort of frightening within its own fear, as it were. A lot of people can manage anxiety, but there are many people who actually have anxiety about experiencing DPDR. I'm happy to say that in my five instances of having it, that it's a storm that is survivable, and it has its own kind of longevity to it. Interesting. One of my DPDR experiences was actually during a therapy session, and I had some sleep deprivation. And so my brain was kind of preset to kind of malfunction. And this patient was talking on and on about how she was frustrated with her fiance. And all of a sudden, I started feeling not in my own world anymore. I started feeling like my chin was actually distended about a foot away from my face, and my fingers felt like tree stumps. They were very, very just kind of like they felt fat and large, and it was almost as if I was having an hallucination. And I have always had to have some concern about sort of going crazy, having a psychotic break, because unfortunately my father had one when he was in his 30s. And so I sort of grew up as an adult wondering whether I might be next, that there might be a genetic component to it. So I'm in this session and I'm debating whether to ask the patient to leave because I didn't want to have a psychotic break in front of her. That didn't seem to me to be fair. Or make the choice of having her stay, because I know as an anxiety specialist, if you escape anxiety, you can exacerbate it. So I debated that for about 10 or 15 minutes. And I think I heard about 5% of what she said, but I think she was having the best session of her life because, I'm a very communicative therapist, so I wasn't interrupting her like I usually do. And I think that she felt like she had a lot to get off her chest. So I think she was having a great time. I don't think she noticed at all that I was completely melting down within my own brain. So I did decide after about a 15-minute debate to treat it as an anxiety reaction and roll the dice that I wasn't actually having a psychotic break. So the session ended after 45 minutes. She left. I put my head down on my desk and cried for a bit because it was so upsetting. And then I realized I was still me. And it occurred to me after she left, that was an anxiety reaction. So, DPDR for many people is in and of itself a spike that they might have their brain take them to that kind of level of distress and sort of disassociation. Let's see here. So for some people, when they have a DPDR experience, because they become so desperate to get them back and re-establish their identity, they become locked in the awareness of being shifted in their experience. And I gave a podcast, I don't know which number, on what's called ACS, altered states of consciousness, which is sort of a almost like, and I don't want to scare anyone here, but it's kind of like a locked in DPDR that doesn't kind of just come and go, but it remains kind of fixed in because the person is so desperate to reestablish that they've gotten themselves back that their brain finds bits of evidence that shows them that they're not back. And then that constant reminder becomes the altered states of consciousness. So that'll be it for anxiety. Mm-hmm. Do you have any questions on that per se, or shall I go on to the next one?
Yeah, please go on to the next one. But no, it was really useful hearing, especially DPDR. It's not something we've covered in a lot of detail. It has come up before, but I think that was useful. And to hear your story, that was good.
Yeah. I'm grateful that I went through that distress, because I can certainly, even though the last one was years ago, I'm very clear as to how it felt. So the next one is guilt. So guilt comes up in a subset of OCD called, or I refer to it as responsibility OCD. This is where people have a spike that they may put others at harm. And they could do that through spreading contamination. So rather than, I might get AIDS by touching a bathroom doorknob, the person has the thought, there may be AIDS on my hand. I don't really particularly have a concern that I might get sick and die, but sort of God forbid I pass those germs on to an innocent person and make them sick. Guilt also comes up in, hit and run OCD. Maybe, on the way to work, I hit someone and there's a injured or dead body on the road with my name on it. And so the person feels not only the anxiety of the spike, but they feel this tremendous sense of guilt as if they've done something wrong and they need to rectify the wrongness. So guilt is a much more complicated emotion than anxiety because, obviously guilt exists within the non-OCD population. People will feel guilty if they've done something that's contrary to their values. But it's interesting that OCD can even just spike the experience of guilt where the person actually, other than OCD moments, would not feel guilty. So, a person with hit and run OCD and they feel guilty that they might have hit someone, if their spike withdraws from that question, then they can look at the exact same incident and not feel guilty because in reality, whatever that means, they haven't actually done something that's violated their values. An interesting component that I learned many, many years ago about how these secondary emotions can influence the OCD sufferers, I worked with a woman who had responsibility OC, and so she took medicine, she took an SSRI, I think it was Prozac. And interestingly, her anxiety completely evaporated. She no longer felt any anxiety about being responsible for harming other people. But the guilt was not touched by the medication. And that's it. What's interesting about the modern medicines is that they can sometimes do an effective job in managing anxiety, but they don't really do such a great job at managing some of the more complex emotions that come along with OCD, like guilt. So second to guilt and often coexisting is the emotion of shame. People with OCD, unfortunately, have shame at a variety of different levels and a variety of different levels of endorsement. So first and foremost, there's a tremendous amount of shame for many people just for having OCD in and of itself. You know, we started at the center, the first behavior therapy support group for OCD sufferers in 1987, I think it was. And one of the reasons we started it is because people with OCD would say things like, I've never met anyone else with OCD, because it's such a quietly, you know, painful existence. Very few people, especially back then, you know, would share that they had OCD. Now, you know, there wasn't such thing in 1987 as online social platforms. And now it's a rite of honor to have OCD. I think people with OCD almost wear it as a badge to be part of a very, very large, growing, and tight-knit community. So in that regard, I think it's terrific that, you know, people are really kind of more and more, not completely obviously, you know, developing much less shame. But shame can also be a spike emotion. So a person might have the thought, you know, oh, that cute 8-year-old girl, you know, looks really hot. Their brain might produce that thought. And because so many people are not knowledgeable that, you know, we're not responsible for our brain activity. And many people think that the thinking brain is one big entity, which is sort of their identity, and they don't know that the brain machine can produce spontaneous independent thoughts that are in no way under our conscious control. So they look at it like, oh, I had the thought, you know, that 8-year-old girl looked hot, and that means I might be a pedophile. That means I am a horrible person. So there's this tremendous, you know, sense within shame of feeling like one's character is indicted by having the thought in and of itself. So emotions like guilt and shame are considered to be irrational. And so interesting is that many people in the CBT community will look at a lot of the shame associations or the guilt associations, and they'll engage in, you know, cognitive restructuring. They'll try to educate the person that these thoughts, no matter what the theme, are not a representation of their identity. And I think there can be some value in that, but not in terms of in the moment managing the spike. So, you know, if a patient has the thought, you know, oh, I might have just, I have the thought of stabbing my child, then in that moment, a therapeutic response is one that shows irrelevance rather than engages in a cognitive disputation. So to have a therapist say, or have the patient say, oh, what's the evidence that I would ever be harmful to this child, I think engages in more kind of undoing and ritualizing rather than an embracing response and a response that conveys irrelevance, which is like, yeah, boy, after I kill my own child, I think I'll kill my neighborhood, you know, to really demonstrate the irrelevance of the brain activity rather than engaging in, you know, a cognitive disputation. And this is where you really need to be a very highly trained professional to really discern the difference between a spike of guilt and shame, which deserves a dismissive response, versus an actual irrational belief in guilt and shame. So the fourth emotion, which is also very complex and confusing for many OCD sufferers and clinicians, is the depression spike. People can feel depressed without being depressed. Depression, as you may know, is a very powerful diagnosis in and of itself. Depression is where a person feels that they themselves are inadequate, Most of depression, not as a spike, but as a condition, is involved in a sense of self-disdain, low self-esteem, if you believe in that. And, you know, treatment is very much oriented in this regard, very powerfully for cognitive therapy. But with OCD, depression can be a spike in and of itself. Just the experience of feeling blue can be a spike about, oh my God, am I depressed? And what's interesting is the depressed person doesn't think, oh my God, am I depressed? That would be horrible. Mm. The depressed person is depressed and they hate being depressed and they want anything else than to be depressed, but they're not afraid of being depressed. And with an OCD depression, the depression is the fear. And so even feeling depressed or even having a depressed thought, say, oh, I hate myself or my life is miserable, that person with an OCD depression reacts with a desperation to undo the legitimacy of the thought. Whereas a depressed person will have the thought, my life is miserable, and they'll just own it as their reality. And so that's the important distinction in, you know, looking at depression as a spike rather than depression as a separate diagnosis. And so people, you know, will have thoughts about having a horrible life, or they'll, so the thought can be the spike of depression, or even the experience of depression in and of itself can be the spike. Oh my God, I'm feeling blue. Therefore, I'm depressed. Therefore, that's horrible that I'm depressed. I need to make sure that I'm not depressed. And so ritualizing becomes around trying to prove that the person's not actually depressed, or they can just be depressed because their brain tells them they're depressed and then they feel depressed. So depression can also be, as you're aware, a very common secondary diagnosis to OCD in terms of if a person has severe OCD and their job is negatively impacted, their social life is negatively impacted, their day-to-day activities are negatively impacted, that can lead to actual depression. But the interesting thing is that this is called secondary depression, because if you restore the OCD's life, the person's life with OCD, their depression goes away. Mm-hmm. So this depression is only as a result because of the devastating impact that OCD has on their life. And it's not a sort of separate diagnosis in and of itself. People who are depressed, you know, when you speak to them, they really sound depressed and they really kind of mean it. Whereas people with OCD depression, they don't sound depressed, but they're spiked about being depressed. And so you get a very different feel being in the room with an actual depressed person than you do with an anxious person who's anxious about being depressed.
And just to jump in there, the two can still exist, though. You can have an actual comorbidity of depression and OCD, and they're not necessarily interlinked. So when you treat the OCD, the depression remains.
That is correct. Yes, you can. There are many potential comorbidities, co-diagnoses with OCD, and depression certainly, you know, could be one of them. So for many people, the idea of being depressed is just like a schizophrenia spike, only they feel that they, you know, that they might, you know, as I said, qualify for the diagnosis. OCD, you know, can generate that secondary depression as opposed to depression separate from OCD, because, you know, with OCD, you know, a person who doesn't have a professionally guided map to manage OCD often, you know, engages in the impulse to escape the condition. And obviously through ritualizing, which is the common escape route, you go deeper into the depression. So in that deeper into the anxiety disorder. So in that regard, it's very, very depressing that the more I try to escape this condition that's really handicapping me and making my life miserable, the deeper into it I go. So the idea of no escape is also a very common generator of depression. So the, let's see here, the fifth emotion is anger. It's not often discussed under the OCD umbrella, but people will experience anger often when their ritualizing is disrupted. So people who have like just right OCD, where they have to get a thought correct in their head in order to then move on. Kind of like, I call it like a green light spike. They need to do something over and over again until their brain gives them a green light to then disengage from the ritual. So often in the middle of a person engaging in these elaborate either mental or behavioral exit strategies, something might disrupt or distract that process. And if you've spent, you know, 20 minutes trying to put a pen down until your brain says, okay, you can go, and something comes in, whether mentally or someone enters the room and distracts, that can be in and of itself extremely frustrating, and that can generate an anger response. Also, people can have a lot of anger, and I'll get into this a little later, just in regard to the element of being so upset with their own brain for malfunctioning in this way. People often engage in a lot of self-blame for their OCD. It's still shocking to me when people, you know, say things like, you know, what did I do to bring this on, or I'm responsible for this condition? And obviously nothing could be further from the truth. So the last classic OCD emotion is disgust. And disgust is often also referred to as kind of like the icky OCD. In this regard, contamination might exist, but not for the sake of it being a sick-inducing contamination, but more the idea of an awareness of some intolerable or undesirable presence of not germ per se, but a molecule, right? So if I touch the bottom of my shoes, I'm aware that my hands are dirty, and I don't necessarily have a concern that that dirt will make me sick, but I don't think it's acceptable to have that dirt on my hands. So in this regard, it's kind of like contamination is wrong as opposed to it being dangerous. And this is a very, very important distinction, because people who have the subset of OCD of disgust rather than the danger of contamination often have a what's called comorbidity or a dual diagnosis of perfectionism. And so in this regard, the germs, the elements of the dirt are considered, you know, wrong. They shouldn't be on my hands. They shouldn't be on my art, my items. And sometimes people have responsibility, OC with disgust, to say, I shouldn't be passing this ickiness to other people. So this is common for people who have what are called like a wet dream or nocturnal emission. They wake up and particles of their semen are on their bed, on their clothing, and they engage in elaborate cleaning rituals because they don't want it either A, to be on them. It shouldn't be. I shouldn't have semen on my own body. Or they have thoughts that they don't want it to be given to other innocent people. And so there's a real concern for the potential spread of things like bodily fluids, let's say toilet particles. There might be poop or urine on a toilet seat. And so things that are considered to be in the world of rules, right and wrong, you know, good and bad, in terms of what should or shouldn't be on my person or should or shouldn't be spread to others, is really under this umbrella of disgust. And it's a very interesting subset of OCD because it's so sort of unique and sort of antithetical to, once again, this being an anxiety disorder, because in this regard, anxiety is often not in any way even part of it. I had done an intake many years ago with someone who had contamination OCD, and I thought, oh, this is going to be a piece of cake. You know, everyone knows that contamination OCD is, you know, the easiest of all subsets to treat. And toward the end of the session, I was kind of smiling with happiness. It's going to be such an easy case. I had forgotten to ask, oh, by the way, is the contamination because you're afraid of getting sick? And he goes, oh, no, I don't care about getting sick. I just don't like the idea that these dirty things should be on me. And as soon as he said that, my brain basically blew up. And I thought, oh, my God, this just became an immensely complicated case. So it's just kind of so important that we're aware of, you know, not only what the person's concerns are, but the rationale that a person has, you know, for these concerns. Because without that information, I might have just gone about treating him with a standard hierarchy rather than really kind of looking at it more from a rule-bound perfectionistic element. So now on to the subsets of OCD emotions that are much less familiar, much less discussed. And the first one I want to mention is the paradox of no feelings. So rather than these top six, for many people, the absence of a feeling can be the spike in and of itself. And so for people who have relationship OCD, relationship substantiation, or, you know, ROCD, as they look at their partner and they desire to feel a loving experience, or they desire to feel an aroused experience at looking at their partner, by the actual effort of trying to establish confirmation that the appropriate feelings are there, the brain pulls a paradoxical trick and it delivers no emotional response. And so in that regard, the void of experience, the absence of experience, becomes in a way terrifying that the person actually has the concern, and the concern is legitimate because, you know, if I looked at my partner and I got anxious, oh, phew, this is OCD, this is anxiety. I'm now so happy I have anxiety, because now anxiety is in and of itself the reassurance that I have OCD, which is the reassurance that I'm not with the wrong partner, that I'm not a pedophile, that I'm not gay. So there are a number of spike themes that are based on the confirmation of emotions. You know, the person who looks at a child and doesn't want to feel aroused, there's the paradox of the brain delivering an arousal response, therefore followed by an anxiety response because arousal shouldn't be happening. So in this regard, you know, these emotions or the absence of emotions are so integrated into, you know, the condition. And I tell people, you know, that OCD is not a thought problem. It's an emotional problem, because if you unplug these emotions, then people don't really give a darn about these spike themes. And so what's interesting is I've worked with people who have up to five different spike themes at once, but they don't exist simultaneously. They exist, let's say, for an hour, a day, or a week. So John, you know, on day one might have a thought of jumping off a balcony. So therefore, he has a suicide spike, which he might get anxious about, or he might have feelings of depression about. And then the next day, John might have thoughts of shouting out some type of an inappropriate expletive at his workplace. And he looks back on jumping off the balcony thought, and he's like, I would never jump off a balcony. That thought's not a problem. Hmm. And so you can see that this condition is so not about the thoughts. So for people to spend any significant time getting into the thoughts as being relevant to be discussed clinically or therapeutically, it's such a profound waste of time, and it's such a profound misunderstanding of the condition. Mm-hmm. It's these emotions that are the engine of OCD's existence, not in any way the thoughts. So the last two emotions I want to talk about are resentment and desperation. And so people, you know, have a tremendous amount of resentment for their own brain activity. They resent that they're, why is my own brain making my life miserable? And that is such a common misunderstanding, you know, of one's own condition, because, you know, it's so important to realize that OCD is not the brain attacking itself. It's the brain in an overprotective mode trying to save itself, because, you know, the amygdala sending out an anxiety response is nothing more than a warning that we would get physiologically if, you know, we were in the forest and we stumbled across, you know, a poisonous snake. We would, our brain would spike in this kind of the same emotional distress signal. And so that signal is designed to protect us and give us the emotional component to deal with this crisis. So the amygdala is sending these signals, obviously, not harm the person, but to save and protect the person and prepare the person for an emergency. So in a way, OCD is kind of like a crazy best friend that's gone nuts trying to protect you by creating anxiety over things that it, by its own design, makes you feel threatened by. But so many people don't have this understanding. And so when their brain produces these thoughts and associations and even experiences, they're very, very frustrated and upset and resentful that this activity is happening. And what's interesting, and this is something that I sort of just kind of tripped upon a few years ago, is that resentment in and of itself can be a ritual. In other words, being resentful of one's brain activity can actually induce more intolerance to that brain activity, which produces more distress about this independent activity that's taking place. And that distress actually, like any ritual like hand washing or Google searching, can actually reinforce the existence of OCD's presence. So, The last emotion is desperation. So many people are desperate to be cured from OCD or to recover from OCD. And that desperation, like resentment, can in and of itself produce a problem in distancing a person from that sort of finish line. Now, the way to achieve the finish line for OCD, as I've said in many articles and in many podcasts, is this wonderful word called irrelevance. So when we show the brain that its signal is irrelevant, the brain stops processing that signal. What's interesting is I have a apartment in the city on Park Avenue, and it's on the 14th floor. And I was told many years ago, oh, any floor above 7, basically you don't hear street noise anymore. Well, the apartment that I live in 3 days a week is on the 14th floor. And I can promise you, I hear street noise. I hear people whispering 14 floors down. I think that it's such a cavern of tall buildings that the sound just travels straight up and there's no relief. But and also I like sleeping with the window open. So, you know, I am certainly reminded that Manhattan is a city that never sleeps because sirens and motorcycles with very loud engines, these are very popular things that drive by at 3 a.m. But what I do is I sort of remind myself, hey, I'm in sort of the best city in the world. Of course, second to London, but don't tell anyone I said that. You know, I'm in here, I'm invested in the world, the city that never sleeps, and I'm reminded of the noises that never come to an end. And in a way, I sort of celebrate the sirens and celebrate the people yelling and the motorcycles. I'm just like, yep, this is Manhattan for you. And so because I sort of smile about these extremely loud noises, They never wake me up because I'm conveying the irrelevance of the noises. In a way, I'm actually kind of celebrating them. And that disposition, that mindset about the noises, shuts down my brain's processing them, you know, as an issue. And what's funny is my son, who also lives in the city, 20 blocks north of where I have this apartment, I was talking to him about the noises, and he's been there 6 years. I've only been there two. And he still complains about the noises, and he's still kept up, and he's still frustrated about the noises. And so he and I have these very different perspectives. And this is going back to the concept of desperation, that the more desperate you are for your brain to not malfunction and send these signals, the more it actually reinforces the brain's tendency to do that, because the brain is paying so much attention to, you know, its own activity. And so, you know, this idea about being cured or going or having relief, the desperation of achieving that actually kind of sets you back from that goal being attained. You know, to look at the brain and say, oh, here's another spike. Hey, this is another opportunity for me to demonstrate irrelevance so I can get closer to the finish line. That actually is the recovery mindset, to see challenges as a recovery opportunity and to take advantage of them in an aggressive way, but to not look at being spiked again or being anxious again as the problem. It's just the brain, you know, once again, malfunctioning and offering a reminder that the person is in danger. So there are a few more emotions, none of which came to me in my preparation for this podcast, but I'm sure in an hour from now, I'm going to be kicking myself. I'll send you an addendum. Yeah. I think that's the top ones that I wanted to discuss today.
Yeah, thank you for that. It's really useful and really insightful. I don't actually have too many questions because I think you've done a good job of breaking them down. With irrelevance, obviously, we previously talked about it before, I think mainly in terms of thoughts. You know, you get a spike and you show that irrelevance because it's obviously the content is nonsense. But here we're talking about irrelevance when you get the spike of emotion, whether that's guilt, disgust, anxiety, whatever, is to kind of use that same irrelevance. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. I'm really glad that you mentioned that, because very, very interesting is sometimes people do an amazingly great job at showing irrelevance to the spike, the actual theme, right? So a person can take the thought, God is a jerk, if they have, let's say, a OCD about religion. So they might get intrusive thoughts from their brain, having negative associations about God, God's a jerk, and all kinds of increasingly inappropriate thoughts. Mm-hmm. And they can do a great job of showing the brain that these thoughts are meaningless and irrelevant. And the brain will often stop sending the actual spike theme. But what can often happen is, and particularly with people who do a very aggressive job, is that the emotional component will stay and the thoughts will no longer be there. So they report feeling off. They report feeling something is amiss. And they say things like their brain is almost looking for the problem. But the person has shown the brain that the theme is no longer relevant to them. So the brain shuts off delivering the thematic type aspect of OCD. There's no more thoughts that are disruptive, but the experience lingers. And in that regard, here the experience, once again, is in and of itself the spike. I'm feeling anxious. I'm feeling uneasy for no reason. This shouldn't be happening. This is a problem. As opposed to, hey, the thoughts are irrelevant. And as you just said brilliantly, the experiences are irrelevant also. And so that's a really important component, that the exposures are not only to the thoughts, but the exposures allow for and welcome the possibility of the emotion to be there or not. And when you show the brain that the emotions are as irrelevant as the thoughts, then the brain will also wind down in delivering that. And so I just want to say quickly what I call recovery. I refer to recovery as OCD as like a dormant volcano. You know, people build houses on the side of dormant volcanoes, although I would never do that. But, you know, volcanoes can be dormant for a year, as in Hawaii. There is always a volcano going off in Hawaii. Or a volcano could be dormant for hundreds of years. So it's that's kind of how we look at, I think, the results of effective treatment is the condition can go into a dormant stage. The amygdala is probably still wired to malfunctioning more likely than the non-OCD person or the non-anxious person, but it can go into this kind of quiet state and remain there for a significant period of time.
Really good point. Absolutely. Because obviously when people first start treatment, they obviously, as you said before, want a cure. And that's setting you up for failure.
That's right. That's right. To see being challenged as the problem, you know, is part of the problem. It's funny because people, you know, going back to the anger subset, you know, people will go on vacation and get spiked even more than when they're living their natural life. And they once again, they think, oh, my God, my brain is trying to disrupt my beautiful vacation. When actually a person on vacation brings the disposition, the mindset of this would be the last place I would ever want to get spiked. Please, 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 brain, don't distract me and disrupt me on this beach vacation or ski vacation. And that attitude of the fragility of being spiked and the intolerance of being spiked is in and of itself a catalyst for the brain, once again, delivering the paradox of bringing on the spike. So it's not that the brain is trying once again to ruin someone's life or take away the joy of a vacation. It's that the brain is saying, you know, hey, is it okay here? Is this an acceptable thought to have? And so it's really important. I tell people to bring along, you know, on their vacations, you know, spike cards, things that remind them of the spike, or levels of contamination that they can pack with them to show the brain that they're not trying to take a holiday from their OCD.
Yeah, really good point. Really good point. Well, let's change directions in the last sort of 5 minutes we have. So I thought about this. I always ask you, all the guests, you know, to pick up the phone and call the 20-year-old self. And I've asked you different ages. And I don't think I've ever done this before. So I want to know, you know, if you could pick up the phone and call your 5-year-old Philipson, what'd you tell him?
As a 5-year-old, I didn't have a father. And so I had tremendous shame about being the only boy I knew in school or any of my friends that didn't have a father to go home to. And I was so ashamed of not having a father that I actually lied about having one because I couldn't face that that shame, that uniqueness about my life. I thought it was a horrible thing. So I would tell him, hey, you know, it's okay that you don't have a father, you know, that you have two older brothers, you have a loving mother, you have a pretty full life, and that some kids don't have fathers, and then that's okay. It's okay to be different. That I think is so common, you know, for all humans growing up, is that when we're aware of our differences, we often attribute shame to those differences. And this is not OCD shame, unfortunately. This is, you know, the real shame of seeing that difference, that uniqueness in my life as being something that I couldn't face letting others know about. So, yeah, I would tell that 5-year-old it's okay not to have a father.
Yeah. Good, cool. Okay. And then lastly, anything else you wish you could have shared today on this topic?
I think I covered all of my notes and then some. So I don't think so. If you have any questions about anything that I could have filled in on, I'd be happy to address that.
No. I think you did a great job of going into the different ones. It's definitely made me think about a couple of the clients I've worked with where, yeah, it helps me see it a bit differently. But that's...
Yeah, I would just say, you know, there remains still so much ignorance about this condition. That's one of the things I really tremendously appreciate about what you've started and have become an incredible celebrity because of, you know, you saw that void. You're aware of the tremendous amount of ignorance, and you're doing an amazing job in trying to erase that ignorance over time. I'm really happy to also be an occasional contributor to, you know, contributing to erasing the ignorance. That these six emotions are not well known as subsets of OCD, as very common components of OCD. I'm very happy to have this opportunity to, you know, further both patients, sufferers, and professionals' knowledge base, but also to say, you know, you really have to work with an expert, you know, in treating OCD. On one hand, OCD is a simple disorder because anxiety has the intelligence of a two-year-old. It's just sort of screaming, give me relief, give me what I want. You know, you have to show that two-year-old that it's not going to get what it wants just because it's throwing a tantrum. But on the other hand, it has so many complexities and nuances to it. You know, very, very different, let's say, from panic disorder, which is I'm either going crazy now or I'm dying now. Basically, those are the two complex elements of panic disorder. Mm. So it is a very complex disorder. It's still, you know, tremendously misunderstood. I'm really glad to have the opportunity to kind of further people's knowledge of some of these elements that are not the more widely spoken about.
Yeah, thank you. I think it's going to resonate. So thanks for your time.
As always, it's a pleasure, and definitely appreciate allowing me to come on and speak on your show.
And here's Steve's addendum that I mentioned at the start of the episode, the bit that he wanted to include but forgot to do it during the interview. So here it is.
Two emotions which are not often discussed as being related to OCD are the experience of an urge and the experience of an impulse. An urge is defined as a strong, irresistible desire to engage in some action. The intrusive thought here is that the person might actually want to engage in this unacceptable behavior, and therefore this issue is an actual representation of some deep-seated interest or an expression of their identity. An impulse is an action which may take place without the person's voluntary control. I might uncontrollably act on an impulse. It's an action which happens and the person only becomes aware of the behavior taking place after reflecting on what just took place. With an urge, patients report that they have an authentic internal desire to perform some behaviors that are considered by them to be against their values. OCD sufferers experience an urge to, say, jump in front of a bus, an urge to gouge out their own eyes, an urge to perform an inappropriate sex act with others. This experience of an urge is profoundly confusing to patients with OCD since they look at OCD as an anxiety disorder. They feel that having an urge means that this subset of OCD sets them apart and exposes them to much greater likelihood of actually acting on the impulses. The idea of having an urge to reach out and touch someone inappropriately or to harm themselves is a very, very disturbing and overwhelmingly disorienting subset of OCD. A closely related word is the idea of having an impulse. I've actually had patients engage in prolonged discussions and debates with themselves and occasionally attempt me to collaborate with this debate in terms of differentiating whether or not they're having an impulse or an urge. An urge here is a hidden desire, and an impulse is a sudden loss of control action. An impulse is more like an external experience that they might perform an act, but it is not necessarily a representation of their character or of their authentic interests. I've had many patients speak about being in church or at a stadium or at some public event or even a party where they experience this idea that they might lose control and yell out something inappropriate. The more they try to ascertain whether or not they are able to engage in an impulse control and not act out on the impulse or to act out on the urge, the more they lose a sense of control or sense of being able to guarantee their safety. In such, these threats of having urges or impulses become self-perpetuating
because the general idea of an urge or an impulse is that we have a loss of control, and a loss of control is very central to many of OCD's different themes. While being in church during a moment of silence, a patient might report that they might lose control and shout out something profound or profane against God. I've had patients speak about being terrified that at a party they will jump up, lose control, and yell out, "I'm a lesbian," or "I'm gay," or "I'm a murderer," or "I'm a child molester." Patients with this terror that they are not in full control of their actions spend endless hours looking inward and attempt to create a proof or confirmation that they are indeed not capable of engaging in this loss of control. Achieving this proof or ascertaining the answer is fruitless and only deepens their lack of certainty.
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. If you enjoy the OCD Stories podcast and would like to support us with a one-time tip / donation, please go to theocdstories.com/support. All tips, no matter how large or small, are greatly appreciated. Please subscribe and rate the show wherever you listen to the podcast. And thank you to NoCD for supporting our work. And if you want to find out more about NoCD, head to go.treatmyocd.com/theocdstories or click the link in the episode description. And quick disclaimer, guys, this podcast is not therapy. It is not a replacement for therapy. Please seek treatment from a trained professional. And until we speak, take care.